With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. On today's episode, I talk to philosopher and political theorist Robert Talese about his book, Sustaining Democracy, which has the subtitle, What We Owe to the Other Side. In my opinion, this is one of the best books on depolarization. Of all the books I've read, Talese was capturing some of the same underlying concepts that I wanted to communicate with my depolarization book, making a convincing case for why politically passionate people should care about toxic political polarization, and talking about the inherent difficulties of being a democratic citizen. We go about it in different ways, of course, but I found some of the underlying ideas to be similar. Talese's book tackles a very important question. How can we engage in politics and democracy when we hold our political opponents in such low regard, when we view them as morally bankrupt and even dangerous? His book emphasizes the important fact that democracy is hard. Democracy is basically just majority rule. Whoever gets more votes can implement a lot of things that other people will strongly disagree with. And then you add in the particulars of American government on top of that, like the Electoral College. All these things mean that all sorts of arbitrary things can happen. Things we view as very bad can be implemented. And so part of reducing our toxic animosity is recognizing these aspects of the world we live in. The fundamental fact that our fellow citizens have a lot of legitimate power in these systems we inhabit, no matter if we think those people are very wrong. And Talese's book contains one of the best explanations of a lesser-known negative aspect of toxic polarization. The fact that it makes political groups less able to form coalitions. It makes more people righteous and overly intolerant of other views, sometimes even views not that far from their own, and makes them overly focused on policing the borders of their group in ways that make them less able to actually do the work of politics and persuade other people and work with other people. And this aspect of polarization, I think, can help explain some of the worst outcomes of extreme division. Because when a society is extremely fractured, it makes it easier for some relatively small, extreme, and dangerous group to come in and seize power, because resistance has been weakened. People are worn down and stressed, or just apathetic. This is what extreme polarization does to us, creates the breeding ground for bad people to be able to do bad things. In this episode, some topics we discuss include, what is polarization? How do we define the problem of polarization? Robert also believes something that I focus on in my book, that the incentives of a lot of the influential political and media systems around us make it unlikely that those same systems and people will help us reduce our animosity, which to me points to the importance of grassroots approaches of spreading the word about these ideas. We talk about some aspects of group psychology that play a role in our divides. For example, the tendency for like-minded groups to grow more extreme and hardened in their views over time. We talk about when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wore a dress with Tax the Rich on it, and Robert gives some thoughts about how us versus them polarization dynamics affected the debate about that on the liberal side. We talk about how our political animosity can make us more likely to start acting in some of the aggressive, biased ways that we dislike about the other side, how it can make us into hypocrites, forgiving bad things that we and our allies do while judging the same behavior very harshly when it's present on the other side. We talk about common objections people have to seeing extreme polarization as a big problem. If you enjoy this episode, I recommend checking out some past episodes about political polarization that I have in the library. You can find a compilation of the politics-related ones on my website, behavior-podcast.com. This conversation was recorded a couple months ago, Since Robert and I talked, I've released my own book on polarization, which is called Diffusing American Anger, and that's available at american-anger.com. A little bit more about Robert Talese. He's currently professor of philosophy and chair of the philosophy department at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where he is also a professor of political science. Okay, here's the talk with Robert Talese, author of Sustaining Democracy. What moved you to write this book? What were your motivations and what problems were you trying to solve?
So the book, Sustaining Democracy, is the title, is a sequel of sorts to a book I published in 2019, which was called Overdoing Democracy. The thesis of the first book, Overdoing Democracy, is that there are certain virtues of citizenship that can be cultivated only when our social lives are not overrun with politics. So it may sound a little counterintuitive, but nonetheless, I think it's true that when everything we do together is an expression of or a communication of our politics, we become worse democratic citizens. That was the thesis of Overdoing Democracy. We need to sometimes do things together. We need to carve out space in our lives where we can do things together that are in no way organized around our political objectives. And, you know, I'm an academic philosopher. I work in political philosophy. If some of your listeners know anything about political philosophy or political theory, the thesis that it's possible to have too much democracy or for democracy to play too large a role in one's life, it's pretty counterintuitive, to say the least. So as I was giving talks, I confronted a lot of the standard objections that I'm sure a lot of the people listening to us can already anticipate. But there was one kind of objection or reaction that really got me thinking. And it was the kind of reaction that went as follows. Some people would say things like, well, okay, Talese, you've convinced me that in order to be a good democratic citizen, I have to make room in my life for cooperative but non-political activities or engagements with fellow citizens. These would be engagements where we're not suppressing our political differences, we're reaching across the aisle. Both of those kinds of activities put politics at the center, after all. But we're looking for activities in which the political affiliations or alignments of the other participants are simply beside the point or unknown to me. Okay, the challenge would go, I think you're right about that. But when we are doing politics, how are we supposed to do it, given that we are already inclined and so strongly inclined to see our political opposition as fundamentally and often irredeemably benighted, ignorant, bigoted, duped, divested from democracy? Isn't that a problem that, you know, we still have to do politics? How can we do it given that we have such low regard for our political opponents? So that got me thinking that, maybe there was another book to be written. And so the Sustaining Democracy book is an answer to that question. How is it, or is it, we might even ask it, is it possible for us to do reasonable, responsible democratic politics, given that cross-partisan animosity, distrust, disgust for the other side is so prevalent in society, and that so much of our social life is already sorted and segregated according to partisan affiliation, such that it's increasingly easy, particularly in the United States, but not only in the United States, to avoid contact with anyone who's not just like you in your day-to-day activities. We can talk more about that later if you like. And so the thought was, maybe under the conditions where the cognitive and affective phenomena that we call polarization are already so high, and that the social world is already so divided into different sectors and quarters according to partisan affiliation, what reason can we have as individuals to try to, you know, live up to the democratic ideal of, you know, trying to be a partner, even with the people whose political judgment we think is terrible, in a common, you know, in the common endeavor of collective self-government as equals? That was the question that drives the Sustaining Democracy book. The subtitle is What We Owe to the Other Side. So it's a book that's in part about depolarization, in part about some of the ways in which a proper conceptualization of the problem of polarization, you know, shows us that some standard strategies for depolarization are unlikely to succeed, and then tries to make a novel case for thinking that it's still worth the time of a democratic citizen to attempt to uphold properly civic relations with those whom they regard as their political enemies. How's that sound?
Yeah, no, that's great. I think it the important part about your book is getting at something that a very important concept, which I think is that democracy is difficult. Like, it's not a it's always going to be a difficult thing, especially as we become more polarized. And you know, you're arguing for seeing that, you know, facing that difficulty head on, because I think in many people's minds, I mean, it almost seems to me like people become kind of spoiled in their thinking about what democracy is. Like, they think it's just, you know, their version of what the world or what democracy should entail is like a continual progress of the things I believe are right. Whereas, right, you know, the fundamental reality is that, you know, you're going to have political losses, even losses that you believe are very harmful to society. And that is a fundamental nature of democracy, because both sides will have narratives about the other side doing harm, and they will have, you know, understandable reasons for why they believe, even if we can very much disagree with them, we can understand the reasons why they can see the other side as doing harm in various ways. And I think, you know, that's why your concepts are so important, because I think, you know, democracy is difficult. And if we're going to survive and be a stable society, I think more people have to grapple with that fundamental difficulty. Would you agree with all that?
Oh, I would agree with all that. I think that, you know, we're so enamored, and I think rightfully so, with the idea of democracy, with the idea of a self-governing community of equals, with the idea of each person counting for one and none for more than one, right? However, you know, whatever, you know, government of, by, and for the people, you know, whatever your favorite sloganized version is of the core of democracy, we're rightly enamored with it. But even at its best, democracy is it's not an easy pill to swallow. Well, let's just think of it sort of, think of it in this way. Democracy is the proposal that you, Zach, can be forced to live according to rules that you reject simply because other people like those rules.
Right. It's a majority, you know, it's majority makes the rules system. It's not a, you know, it's not a magical
That's right.
system.
That's right. And so the idea that in a democracy, we have to recognize that sometimes the state, the government, the political agencies and institutions that run the country are required, are bound to enact policy that we think, in our best judgment, and maybe in our informed judgment, and maybe we could even be correct, they have to, you know, the government is required under certain conditions to enact policies that we know are unjust. That's what democracy is, that it forces us to recognize the category of legitimately enacted injustice. Now, within certain bounds, right, there's certain kinds of severe forms of injustice that can never be legitimately enacted. That's what the Bill of Rights is supposed to help us discern. But within those broad constraints about fundamental political rights of human beings and so forth, or citizens, still a lot of room for where the government is rather is required to enact policy that enjoys a certain degree of support among the people, even when the people are wrong.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, we're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
And so the thought that's associated with Jane Addams and John Dewey, that the cure for the ills of democracy is always more democracy, is often thought to suggest a further thought that I think is less obviously true. In fact, I think it's untrue, that if we just get democracy right, you know, the world will be sweetness and light, right? That, you know, that every injustice has as its core the failure of democracy. I just think that's got to be false, because part of what it is for us to live together as political equals is that we have to recognize that our fellow citizens get to make up their own minds about things. And when we politically disagree, maybe with respect to certain kinds of issues, it's no big deal, you know, who's going to be dog catcher or whatever. But when we politically disagree over tax policy or environmental policy, over immigration, over healthcare, that's a disagreement about what justice requires. And so, you know, if Zach, you and I disagree on one of those issues, I have to see your view as on the side of injustice, as something less or other than what justice requires. So if you get your way democratically, I have to think, well, the world is less just than it would have been had I gotten my way. And so the thought that, you know, democracy is this engine that produces justice just seems to me to be false. And I think that we're giving short shrift to the value of democracy when we don't recognize the slightly less attractive features of it. Because it seems to me that for all of its flaws, you know, Winston Churchill is right. This is the best there is, right?
Best we know.
How's that? Right. Good.
And one thing I say to emphasize that point of, you know, just how fundamentally we can disagree on even the simplest moral problems. You know, there's the well-known trolley problem, you know, the philosophical or ethical problem. And you can imagine, you know, we can disagree on even the simplest problem of whether you, you know, for people that don't know, whether you pull the lever to divert this train and have it kill, you know, as opposed to killing four or five people, have it kill one person, but you have to make the decision to pull the lever. And we can disagree, you know, people have argued over this for a long time, and you can even imagine polarization around that issue where, you know, a version of the trolley problem in politics where, you know, liberals were on one side or conservatives were on the other, and they very much viewed the other side's stance as completely immoral and unjust. And, you know, the fact that we can get so divided on even the simplest issues should give us pause when we, you know, form very certain confident views about, you know, how evil the other side is. And and getting back to your point about the way I view these polarization problems, like you were saying, more and more people focusing on these issues can be unhealthy, because it's almost like a magnifying glass effect where you're focusing all the social energy in one place and creating this destabilizing and anger emotion producing thing in one area. And it even, you know, Ezra Klein talked about this in his book. You know, he ended his polarization book with the point, you know, we focus too much on these national problems that we have no influence over, and we just are becoming morally outraged and throwing basically, you know, energy into this divide that, and, you know, maybe it would be better if we focused on local things that we could actually influence and things in our community, as opposed to, you know, adding fuel to this polarization fire. And I'm curious if you'd agree with some of that.
Well, the Klein book is interesting. It's written for a particular audience. It's more of a narrative than...
I found it very biased, personally.
I could see why one might say that. It's of its kind. It's a perfectly fine book. One thing I think is important, maybe, just to take a step back, I think it's important to sort of introduce some distinctions when we're talking about polarization. You know, there's so much, especially in political commentary and in journalism, there's so much talk about polarization and it's being bad, that there's not a lot or not a similarly, not a similar degree of talk about what it is. And I think that there's too little talk about what it is and why it's bad. You know, it's not hard to come across political theorists, political commentators, politicians even, who talk about polarization in a way that I think betrays or suggests the view that animosity among citizens is always bad to any degree, mm-hmm. or disagreement always needs to be resolved in some way that leaves all parties satisfied, that rancor is a sign of a democratic dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to think all that's false. I think that democracy runs on disagreement and division. I think that, again, part of what it is to respect or to fully acknowledge our political equality is to recognize that, you know, adult citizens get to make up their own minds about things, and they get to make up their own minds about how they should make up their own minds. So what level of information is required, where the information needs to come from, these are all things that, you know, I'm not required as a citizen to defer to anybody else's judgment about. Now, what that means is that, you know, we're going to, you know, even when we're all as citizens trying to do our best as custodians of the public good, it's very unlikely that our judgments about political matters are going to converge onto some common view. So it seems to me that the late 20th century and early 21st century political philosopher John Rawls got something right. Political disagreement over, you know, pretty central normative matters is the direct implication of our freedom and equality. It's not, therefore, a mark of some kind of political failing. In fact, Rawls said, consensus is suspicious. It seems to me that disagreement is inescapable in a society of free and equal people. And it also seems to me that political disagreement is disagreement over pretty important values like justice and freedom, liberty, dignity, respect. And so the idea that if we're doing democracy correctly or properly, there won't be heated tones and there won't be real division and there won't be, you know, real animus strikes me as a mistake. So it seems to me that depolarization, or let me put it slightly differently, the problem of polarization, it cannot be simply the problem of political divisions and divisiveness and dislike and animus. Some degree of divisiveness and animus and dislike is just a necessary part of politics when you're aspiring to realize the ideal of a society of free and equal self-governing citizens. So if polarization is a problem, where is it? Right? What is it? Where does it reside? And I want to suggest that, you know, the way to think about the problem of polarization is to say, well, polarization is the problem of, or the problem of polarization is better understood as follows. Too much of our political division is driven by cognitive and affective forces that don't track actual differences of opinion. Right. So, you know, your listeners might be aware of this, but it always is worth repeating. You know, the forget about parties and political platforms and party leaders and politicians. Forget about them for a second. The American electorate is no more divided over rubber hits the road political policy questions than it was in the 1990s. In fact, on a lot of, you know, pretty central questions of political public policy. In fact, with respect to a lot of the questions of political policy that were the main sites of political division in the 90s, think about gay marriage in the 90s, right? Stem cells, you know, the American electorate has actually come closer to consensus. That is, we're less divided over certain kinds of what were once very divisive issues, you know, 30 years ago. We're less divided now. The problem in American politics at present is not that we have these deep divisions among the citizenry about what the government should be doing. It's that we believe that we have these deep divisions over what the government should be doing. And on the basis of the perceived or the assumed divisions of that kind, we dislike each other more. We distrust each other more. We walk around with caricatured versions of what the other side thinks and what they believe and how they live, despite the fact. So we dislike each other more, but have actually relatively less that divides us at the level of policy. That strikes me as the problem of polarization. It's that our perceived political divisions are a kind of mirage. How's that sound to you?
Yeah, I think I think we're largely on the same page, because in the book I'm working on, and sometimes in the podcast, I spend time like you defining the problem is important. And the problem, as you say, is not that we disagree or even strongly disagree. It's that the seeing the role of these negative emotions, how we view the other side, the distorted views, not just about, because there, like you said, there can be distorted views about how much the other side disagrees with us, the number of people that held X, position. But there's also distortions around like the motivations even for the things that we strongly disagree on, like specific issues, immigration. We can have these worst case scenario interpretations of what the other side's stances are about and view them as, all as bad as the worst people on that side, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, it's very important to define the problem. And I think one thing I say to, I often say to politically passionate people to get them to see the wisdom of these ideas. And I think it's tough because, the word depolarization is probably not the best word, because I think people interpret that to mean we're going to depolarize your beliefs and move your beliefs to some moderate state. And I think it's increasingly seemed to me it's not a great word, because that's how people interpret it. So it's not about changing their beliefs or, as you say, their emotional investment in those beliefs and political goals and willing to work hard towards things. It's about examining the role that these negative emotions play. And I try to tell people, the politically passionate people, can you see how this anger, this dehumanization, that this worst case thinking about the other side helps create the very things we're angry about? And to give an example of that, James Druckmann and his colleagues had a study showing how higher levels of partisan animosity before COVID were later linked with more polarized, more extreme COVID stances on either side, either being really for strong COVID restrictions or practices, or being for super lax COVID reactions and stances. And this is just to say, that it's helping make the case that our anger can be helping create and polarize, create the very things we're angry about, and helping shift our beliefs, people's beliefs to the outside based on that anger. And I'm curious if you think that's a persuasive argument to people that are politically passionate.
Well, I think it's true Now, you know, sometimes good philosophical insight is not always does not always run in tandem with what's persuasive. Mm-hmm. But one thing just to say about the kind of research you're just citing, it also looks as if strong partisanship was positively correlated with over or underestimations of the kind of threat and severity.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So not only was it in favor of the policies, it was
it distorts our views of reality.
That's good. So yeah, I think that's right.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Life needs more Cedar Point, and that's what you'll get with the 2024 Summer Pass. Get unlimited visits through Labor Day plus free parking. Enjoy spectacular rides, unforgettable live shows, and drive the sky on Top Thrill 2, the world's only triple-launch vertical speedway. It's all yours for just three payments of $25 after initial payment, online only plus applicable taxes and fees. But hurry, because this price goes up July 8th. Get your Summer Pass today, only at cedarpoint.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, we're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet, empowering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Now, let me just sort of, again, make the a further distinction, given what Zach, you were just saying. We can talk about polarization as the sort of pulling apart of the parties or pulling apart of the political units, the political movements, the conservatives, the liberals, the progressives, however you want to characterize it, you know, and the consequent falling out of the common ground between them, so that there's this chasm between the left and the right that doesn't seem bridgeable without somebody making a rotten compromise or conceding something to evil. There's that, and you know, maybe some degree of even that kind of divisiveness among political units like parties. Some degree of that seems to me to be not only inevitable in a democracy, but, you know, maybe a sign of democratic health. You know, after all, when you've got the parties that are sharply divided over identifiable issues, makes the job of the citizen figuring out where his or her allegiances lay, given that as a voter, the agenda is already set by the time you show up at the voting booth. It's like, yeah, well, you know, the party's making salient their differences by sort of focusing on their fundamental disagreements and their dislike for one another, you know, make the job of being a voter a little bit easier. Now it's really clear, like, well, what party stands where on which issues that I care about, you know, all that stuff becomes very explicit and salient. So some degree of that pulling apart of the two parties so that they stand in clear opposition, in part by each one signaling their dislike of the other side and their opposition to the other side, you know, maybe some degree of that isn't bad. But as we were just saying, you know, the affective and cognitive side of polarization, and what I would want to say are sort of distinct phenomena that are called polarization, is where I think the right diagnostic focus is. Because, again, it seems to me that the problem is that our political divisions, including the party divides, are kind of driven by a kind of hallucinated sense of who our fellow citizens are. And in fact, it seems to me that the political parties and the candidates and the campaign managers and the pundits kind of benefit from this circumstance. And that's why I don't think that any, you know, solution will be forthcoming from large-scale institutions and political leaders and the parties. They benefit from this imagined illusion, you know, illusory division. But the affective and cognitive phenomena, I just want to say a little bit about that. So, you know, there's this well-studied, robustly documented cognitive phenomenon that's called belief polarization. And belief polarization is the tendency of members of like-minded groups, particularly when they are in one another's presence, to become more extreme advocates and more extreme versions of themselves. So let me sort of make that distinction one more time, right? So we could think of political polarization as this sort of sociological phenomenon of the major parties or the major political groups pulling to their ideological poles and letting the common ground fall out between them so that there results in a chasm and a lot of frustration and log jams and paralysis at the policy level. Belief polarization is something different. Political polarization is a metric, we might say, of the division between the right and the left, or the liberals and the conservatives, or the Democrats and the Republicans. Political polarization, that is a metric of some kind of distance between two things. Belief polarization is not a metric of the distance between two things. Belief polarization is a phenomenon that occurs within a like-minded group. If anything, it's a metric of the distance between your former and your present self. So when groups of like-minded people interact, they become more extreme, they become more confident, they become less inclined to see counter evidence as weighty, they become more inclined to dismiss as biased and unreliable any source of counter evidence to their view. And even more importantly, as like-minded groups become, you know, shift into these more extreme doxastic, that is, attitudes with respect to their beliefs, they also become more ready to act on the more extreme beliefs that they hold. So in something that some of your listeners will be familiar with, the phenomenon called the risky shift. The more extreme and confident we become, the more tolerant of risky behavior we become when the risky behavior can be shown to be in the service of the more radical and confident beliefs we hold. Now, like-minded groups become more extreme in their beliefs and their sort of cognitive attitudes. But at the same time, and for reasons that are not hard to discern, our more extreme selves are also more affectively negatively disposed towards anybody who's perceived not to be a member of the in-group or not to be a member of our like-minded group. So as we become more extreme, we also become more distrustful of, more suspicious of, more likely to attribute negative character traits, negative intellectual traits, and untoward motives towards anybody we perceive to be on the outside of our group. So let me put the package together then. Interaction among like-minded people shifts us into adopting more extreme beliefs and cognitive stances towards our commitments. That makes us more ready to act on their behalf, but it also is positively tied with escalating negative emotions, negative affect towards anybody who's perceived to be outside our group. And so, you know, this is, you know, if you've been to high school, you know what this is. This is just cliques. Right. And so, you know, when groups become more extreme and more insular in the ways I just described, they also become more hierarchical. Right. They become more and more reliant on tastemakers within the group to establish what it takes to be a member in good standing of the group. Belief polarized groups become more reliant on internal slogans and behavioral cues that signal to other members their allyship. They begin to dress alike. they begin to pronounce certain words in the same way. In fact, you could already see this. I'm not sure, Zach, if you're aware of some of this research about the pronunciation of words having a partisan valence.
Yeah, I've seen.
You know,
lots of things. Yeah, right.
So, you know, if you're listening to somebody on the news and you're wondering if, you know, where their partisan affiliation lies, wait for them to say the name of the country, IRAQ. Iraq or Iraq. And, you know, and I don't even have to say where the, you know, where the partisan identification lies in that. Iran and Iran. Iran is a clear signal, the pronunciation Iran is a clear signal that you're dealing with somebody who's a liberal. So the thought that is that these heavily belief polarized groups become, you know, not only more extreme, but more insular, more hierarchical. And ultimately, they become increasingly fixated on policing the borders between the in-group and the out-group. And I think that strikes me, maybe Zach, you're on the same wavelength there. That strikes me as politically counterproductive. When our political coalitions are subject to internal dynamics that lead the coalition members to become more and more focused on detecting posers and fakers within the group so that they can be expelled, strikes me as just, you know, from the point of view of real politics, strikes me as just counterproductive.
Right. Building coalitions. Yeah,
but you need to be right. If you want to be an effective democratic citizen, you got to join a choir. You want the choir to grow.
Right.
You can't have it shrink. And so, you know, it looks to me like polarization isn't only a I want to even say in the Sustaining Democracy book, the one of the central pillars of the argument is that, yeah, you know, the dysfunction of polarization is not properly located within the animosity for the other side, the divisiveness towards the other side, the disgust and distrust with the other side. I mean, those might be problems too, but part of the problem of polarization is the impact it has on our alliances. It makes us less able to be a member of a successful political coalition. Can I just give one real quick example that I have some initial, mainly anecdotal data about in the form of a couple of online threads, but
sure.
You know, Zach, you may remember, you know, 2 years ago, whatever it was, the Met Gala where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wore a dress with a slogan on the back of it. Do you remember the slogan?
Yeah, it was something like something about doing something to the rich or something.
Tax the rich.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. So she was wearing this very elegant dress, and it had in big red, you know, red letters, you know, looked like it was painted, to even spray painted, tax the rich. I happened to just, for reasons that were, you know, incidental, I happened to just be following some social media threads about the Met Gala and all the rest the night that this was happening. And I saw something very, very interesting develop with respect to AOC's dress. And I think it's a nice illustration of the internal dysfunction, you know, the way polarization undermines our coalitions. So she's on the, you know, there's live streaming, there's all kinds of things. AOC is wearing a dress that says tax the rich on the back. And, you know, you start seeing people commenting and, you know, I love her so much and, you know. And eventually people on a couple of the threads start posting like, yeah, every billionaire, that there are billionaires is criminal. And others would say, yeah, Jeff Bezos needs to pay his fair share. And others would say, all property is theft. You know? So you started getting different levels or different grades of, liberal to progressive to more radically progressive ideas about what the slogan tax the rich might mean, ranging from, you know, billionaires ought to be, you know, it ought to be a crime to be a billionaire, to we should have a much more aggressively progressive tax system. And I started watching, I'm like, well, this is interesting because, you know, what exactly does tax the rich mean? I guess it's consistent with, you know, a fairly moderate but left, you know, argument for, you know, progressive taxation. Yeah, Jeff Bezos isn't paying his fair share. Close the loopholes, you know, this kind of thing. And it's also consistent with, could be consistent with, you know, more radical doctrines like, you know, any earnings above a certain number, you know, just
capped.
You know, just get
take
just
it all
taken back by the state. So I started monitoring this because I thought this was interesting. And what was interesting about it was how quickly the threads devolved, not into sort of, you know, disorderly, you know, name calling over the policy. You saw people initially saying things like, if you think tax the rich just means we need a, you know, we need to close the loopholes in the existing tax system, you might as well be Ronald Reagan. Right. So there was that kind of initial, like, we're disagreeing over what the right tax policy is. But that lasted for only a couple of minutes. Ultimately, the threads became sort of a kind of mudslinging about who the real progressives in the discussion were. And that struck me as deeply dysfunctional for a political coalition. It's like when the fact that we disagree, we all want something to change. We could say the participants in this discussion all wanted something to change about the tax structure. And they wanted changes in the tax structure that moved in a progressive lefty kind of direction. But they gave up on the discussion of what the right tax policy should be and embraced a different discussion. Who is the real progressive? And that just looked to me, okay, well, this is no way to achieve any political goal, is to succumb so quickly to the tendency to give up on the substantive discussion and then just try to establish the borders between the authentic progressives and the posers. Mm-hmm. That's what polarization does to us.
That's what I loved about your book. Yeah, I really liked your focus on the hidden, basically the less discussed aspects, negative aspects of this, you know, us versus them polarization, and how it makes, you know, the groups more fractured and more contentious, even within amongst people that are quite politically aligned. And, you know, we can see, you know, that you gave a great example, and it's like, if we can see this in so many ways on the left and the right, you know, people just become more focused on purity. And, you know, there was a good article about progressive nonprofits being, you know, going through chaos in the wake of the George Floyd and anti-racism discussions. And it was in The Intercept, and a good article for anyone who wants to look at that. But it was just an example of how even amongst people that are quite politically aligned, we become unable to form coalitions, and politics for people that actually want to get something done is about forming coalitions. And, you know, I think it's also related to the saying, you know, perfection being the enemy of the good, you know, your sense of perfection being the enemy of actually getting something practical done. And both sides become more and more fractured in that way. And people become less willing to speak up about to the more polarized and angry people in their group, which I think gets back to the, you know, how I would say our us versus them animosity helps create some of the very problems that upset us, because the more that we give power to the more angry and highly polarized, the more that gives power to the highly polarized on the other side who have a lot of anger and so on and so on. I really liked your focus on that part of it, the internal part.
I appreciate that. Can I just sort of, I want to add one thing. I agree with what you're just saying. Not only does polarization sort of create the conditions that we tell ourselves we are lamenting and, you know, regret. Yeah, it creates the very conditions that we think are so terrible. I want to suggest one further thought, though. Polarization turns us into the kind of people we hate the other side because we imagine they are like that, right? Polarization punctuates within us the character traits that we claim to be the basis of our disgust and animosity towards the other side, right? But put it this way, polarization encourages in us not only the thought or the idea, but the attitudes, the disposition, and the practices that are fundamentally organized around the idea that democracy is possible only when everyone's just like me. And that strikes me as a fundamentally anti-democratic idea, that democracy, there can only be democracy when people are just like I am. It's fundamentally anti-democratic to think that. But that's what polarization does. And often we find ourselves in that heightened state of belief and affective polarization because we're engaged sincerely in democratic activity.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Life needs more Cedar Point, and that's what you'll get with the 2024 Summer Pass. Get unlimited visits through Labor Day plus free parking. Enjoy spectacular rides, unforgettable live shows, and drive the sky on Top Thrill 2, the world's only triple-launch vertical speedway. It's all yours for just three payments of $25 after initial payment, online only plus applicable taxes and fees. But hurry, because this price goes up July 8th. Get your Summer Pass today, only at cedarpoint.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, we're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
So, yeah, like you say, it's counterintuitive and a bit... Yeah, it's hard to examine. It's hard to solve for a reason, because so many of the things, I think we don't have analogies for. Like, we have a lot of analogies to the natural world, but I feel like this is such a human dynamic that's very unique, that it's hard to for us to understand the complexity of how these dynamics work. It's something I often think about. Like, if we had better natural world analogies for this, it might be easier to tackle. But I know we only got a few minutes left, so I wanted to ask you,
sure,
when it comes to what we might do about these problems, like, say, you know, we could put you in, made you king of the U.S. for a while, and you were given full reign to combat this problem. Do you have confidence opinions on what we would do at a policy level? Because I know in your book you do focus on, you know, the need for internal, more people to do internal examinations and considerations, which I believe is hugely important to kind of a cultural change. But I'm curious about the if you take some specific steps policy wise.
Well, so, you know, I don't like the framing of being king, but
well, you know, I specifically chose an extreme,
but so I think that we make progress in thinking about polarization and depolarization when we focus on the cognitive and affective aspects of polarization. That enables, I think, a pretty solid response. The Sustaining Democracy book tries to develop it to sort of polarization skeptics. Polarization skeptics are the people who think that, you know, polarization is a false diagnosis because it's really just a kind of both-siderism, or it's a, you know, the idea that we need to depolarize is really just a polite way of saying that nobody can really believe anything, or that you've got to, you know, invite, you know, the local white supremacists over for coffee and, you know, these kinds of things. When you focus on the internal dynamics of polarization, the way in which polarization undermines our capacity to be members of a functional democratic coalition, I think then you get a different kind of argument for why we need to start thinking about depolarization, which is that, Yeah. If you want to pursue justice, you want to see justice done, you've got to hold a coalition together. And polarization, forgetting about the people who are your oppositions or your opposition or your obstacles, polarization doesn't go away when you start ignoring your opposition. It just turns you against your political allies. So two very quick things. You know, I think it's important to realize that polarization doesn't get fixed. It's not something that can go away. Polarization in its cognitive and affective dimensions are just, you know, part of our cognitive makeup and affective makeup as the kinds of creatures that we are. So the task is not to fix polarization or to eliminate it or to eradicate polarization. It's to manage it and to keep it within constraints that render it not so dangerously toxic as current levels of polarization in that affective and cognitive sense, the degree to which affective and cognitive sense of polarization has become toxic. We need to contain that and constrain it in certain ways. Now, I've got two pretty counterintuitive, I think, suggestions, and I don't know that either of them amounts to much at the level of political policy, although it does suggest certain kinds of policy upshots. First thing to say is that I don't think that the problem can be fixed at the level of the president and the Senate and the Congress and the law. I don't think that the problem of polarization is the kind of thing we should count on any existing political institutions or agents to fix. They benefit too much from it. When the citizenry is divided in the way that the U.S. citizenry is divided, it makes the task of a campaign manager and a political strategist a lot easier, because it's so much easier to just talk about and to stoke your allies, your likely voters' distrust of the other side. So much easier to do that than to actually lay out the details of policy in ways that can keep your likely voters on board. And so politicians and parties and candidates are the beneficiaries of polarization. So we can't count on them to fix it. Two things, initial thoughts. One is that I think that, as I argue in the first book, and what turns out now is a trilogy, there's a third book coming. The first book is Overdoing Democracy, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Zach. And there I said, look, we need to reclaim segments of social space, you know, regions of our social environment, for engaging in activities where we're cooperating with others but don't know what their politics are like. That's not suppressing political difference. That's just doing something where politics is beside the point. The fact that I'm sure many listeners have found what I just said puzzling. There could be an activity that I'm engaging with others that's cooperative and politics is beside the point. What in the world could that be? That this strikes us as a strange thought is, I think, a symptom of the depth of the problem of polarization. So here's just one very, very quick example. And again, this is not at the level of, you know, large-scale policy, but, you know, as listeners might be able to discern, although I live in Nashville, I'm not originally from Nashville. I'm not originally from the South. You know, that's New Jersey you're hearing in my voice. So when I moved to Nashville in 2001, you know, I don't know anything about country music, or I don't know anything about sort of country music traditions. I know a little bit more now than I did when I moved from New Jersey. But one of the things my wife and I started doing, you know, a little while after we came down to Nashville, is that we started investigating, as it were, bluegrass and country music as a sort of American musical traditional idiom. And eventually I started going, you know, every now and then, not regularly anymore since the pandemic, although maybe I'll start up again, started going to a bluegrass venue. It's a dive bar in Nashville that has real sort of top quality bluegrass. Now, part of what was interesting about that activity is that, you know, you go to the venue, don't know a lot about the idiom of this style of music. I know some things about music. I don't know anything about this particular idiom. But because the place is just sort of like, you know, you sit down at a table and whoever's sitting down next to you is just somebody, you know, could be a stranger. You know, I started to get an appreciation for the way in which other attendees at this, what turned out to be a sort of open mic kind of bluegrass jam night at this one venue. I got a real, you know, appreciation for the kind of command that some people who just happened to be sitting around me on these evenings had of the music. Where, you know, you just be sitting there and you're listening, the guy, stranger, sort of leans over and says, oh, you know, the mandolin player's great-grandfather wrote this song. And you say, oh, really? Like, oh, yeah. And, you know, the bass player is the guy who, you know, performed on, you know, a Johnny Cash song. And eventually you realize that there's a tradition and an idiom. And even further, with one or two particular attendees at these events, I started getting the appreciation for their aesthetic sensitivity. You know, eventually just by showing up, you know, people would say, oh, yeah, it's you again. You know, I don't know who these people are. They don't even know my name, but they recognize me. And, you know, listening to them talk about the aesthetic properties of the music or the way in which the song was performed or how the performers on the stage, you know, did something that was unusual in this particular performance of this particular song. You know, these are things I was totally aesthetically completely insensitive to. I wasn't able to hear, and I'm a musician. I wasn't able to really hear some of the nuances that, you know, these guys who just happened to be showing up like me were very sensitive to. And I thought this was important for democratic politics for the following reason. We weren't doing politics, right? No, we were talking about, we were experiencing the music. You know, the political theorist in me, you know, had all kinds of reasons to think that the particular people I'm thinking about right now probably don't vote for the same people I vote for in national and local elections. They probably have political views that I don't accept. Who knows, right? But nonetheless, in the course of, you know, interacting with these guys about this music, I was able to perceive their virtues in a way that wasn't so tightly tethered to my sense of who's on the right and who's on the wrong side of the political issues of the day. That is, in talking about this aesthetic form, I was able to appreciate these other people's perspectives on this music. And that had the following effect. Were I to discover what I suspect might be the case, that the particular people I'm thinking of right now are my political foes, are on the opposite side of all the things I care about politically, were I to discover that, I would have a much harder time simply writing them off as human beings. Because I engaged with them in an activity that allowed me to see the ways in which they have values that are legible to me is worthwhile, sensitivity that seems to me to be sophisticated and the product of a kind of intelligence and attentiveness. They care about things.
Right. Seeing their humanity.
And seeing them in a context where they could display their virtues in a way that's not tethered so tightly to their partisan identity. I think that was civically deeply, deeply important. So one of the things I would say then is that insofar as it's possible at the level of policy to create spaces, social spaces, physical spaces, that are suited to that kind of interaction, we should pursue that. Now, let me just put a little bit of meat on the bones. The third book in the trilogy, which I'm writing now, is about the political value of solitude. Part of the argument there is that our capacities for reflection, for imagination, for thinking about what's possible in our political world, for thinking about how we can get from where we are to someplace better, these are essential reflective, introspective tasks for the democratic citizen, that our current political environment, saturated social spaces with politics, our current social environments don't permit. And so part of the argument there, and this connects up with the thought about the bluegrass bar, is that we need to understand that, or start understanding that, democracy needs an active citizenry, yes, but democracy also needs a reflective citizenry. And some of the present modes, and indispensable, I would even say, modes of democratic action, undermine our reflective capacities. And so part of the task of better fulfilling the democratic ideal of a self-governing community of political equals is to figure out ways to create more social spaces where people can engage in a kind of solitary reflection. And so, on this view, museums and parks become really central democratic institutions, not amenities, not luxuries that well-off districts in the country might be able to afford, but the idea that there's a public democratic service that museums and parks and even more importantly, public libraries play that makes them democratically essential spaces for people to be alone with their reflection is really, really important. So if I were, just to go back to your question, Zach, I'm sorry, this is a long-winded way of putting it. If I were somebody in charge of this, I'd say, yeah, we need a way to combat the encroachment of commercial interests into the entirety of our social spaces. And we need to find ways to preserve, restore, and create social spaces of a particular kind, social spaces where people can be alone with their thoughts.
Yeah, I like that part about your book too, focusing on the internal thought. And
right.
It really spoke to me because, you know, some of the things that I think where I've reached good understandings of the problem and what to do about it, and understanding the other side too, you know, the things that other people think was just me sitting around thinking about it, you know, and giving it thought. It wasn't like I wouldn't have been able to do that in the heat of, you know, debate or, you know, reading social media or, you know, having conversations. It's something that only came from going inside and thinking the things through. But so I thought that was a really important point.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, this has been great, Robert. Thanks a lot for your time. And looking forward to your next book. And I'd like to read your first book in the trilogy too. I haven't read that one. But thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was really nice to talk to you. And thanks for the invitation.
That was a talk with Robert Talese, author of Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe to the Other Side. I highly recommend his book. It's one of the best books on the subject I've read. And just to note that my own book, Diffusing American Anger, is out now on ebook and in the Kindle store. You can learn more about that at american-anger.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. Thanks for your interest and thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Life needs more Cedar Point, and that's what you'll get with the 2024 Summer Pass. Get unlimited visits through Labor Day plus free parking. Enjoy spectacular rides, unforgettable live shows, and drive the sky on Top Thrill 2, the world's only triple-launch vertical speedway. It's all yours for just three payments of $25 after initial payment, online only plus applicable taxes and fees. But hurry, because this price goes up July 8th. Get your Summer Pass today, only at cedarpoint.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, we're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.